I'd like to read some verses from the Rodwell translation, which was completed in 1861. See if you can tell which book this comes from, because it's going to sound different to you. The angel said, O Mary, verily God announceth to thee the word from him. His name shall be Messiah Jesus, the Son of Mary, illustrious in this world and in the next, and one of those who have near access to God. And he shall speak to men alike when in the cradle and when grown up, and he shall be one of the just. She said, How, O my Lord, shall I have a son when man hath not touched me? He said, Thus God will create what he will. When he decreeth a thing, he only saith be, and it is. It is different from what we're used to, isn't it? Anyone want to care what book I was reading from? No one? Luke? Those are the two main choices that I get. I actually read from the Quran, the holy book of Islam. Pretty sneaky of me to do that, wasn't it? You know, but I was surprised when I first read that, too, from the Quran, as many like you were. It's interesting that the Quran does recognize the virgin birth of Jesus. And it also recognizes Jesus as a prophet. But why did I read from the Quran? Am I going to give you new truths that's been revealed only to me? No new truths, rest assured. So why did I read from the Quran? Well, once again, radical Islam is in the news with the killings recently in Paris, and then right after that in San Bernardino, California. And of course, radical Islamists became very real to all of us here in the United States after the horrific events of 9/11. And of course, we have ISIS in the news daily, taking over parts of Syria and Iraq as they continue to kill and commit atrocities, and they do it in the name of Islam. ISIS has replaced Al-Qaeda as the number one terrorist group in the world, but Al-Qaeda is still out there, and they are still ready to kill in the name of Islam, as is the Taliban. And let's not forget the continuing conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, between Muslims and Jews. There's still the fight for Jerusalem. There's still the fight for Israel/Palestine. And then there is the hatred that Muslim extremists have for America. And that hatred is increasing. And all that we just mentioned continues. I think, as we know, it's only going to get worse. And because of all that, many people have wanted to know more about Islam and the people who practice it, especially the people from the Middle East. Now, I imagine that the sales of the Quran have increased in our country in the last decade or so because people are buying them to see what it says. I did. But the good news is that people are still buying the Holy Bible because many people who profess to be Christians want to know what it says and because they have questions. And perhaps they will find answers to their questions if they do read those new Bibles that they bought. And one question that Americans want to know is, why do these terrorists hate us so? And many people want to know why we're so involved in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and why we're allied with Israel and not the Palestinians. And perhaps the biggest question that people want to know is, when will all this end? Once the wars in Syria and Iraq are over, once ISIS is destroyed, once Al-Qaeda is eliminated, many Americans will think that it all has ended and will want to go back to the comfortable lives that they once enjoyed before Islamic terrorism was brought home to all of us. In fact, I think many Americans will insist on it. But this war on terrorism won't end when ISIS and Al-Qaeda are destroyed, if they will be. It won't end when the wars in Syria and Iraq are over, if they will be. It won't end if Israel and Palestine agree to exist as two separate states. So when will it end? Well, the answer is not found in the Quran that I first read out of. Instead, it's found in this book, the Holy Bible. And today we are going to look to this book to see when it will end, as well as when it all began. And we'll see that why this war on terrorism won't end before the return of Jesus Christ. The hatred between Arabs and Jews is not going to end without the direct intervention of the same Jesus. And Muslim extremists will not stop hating until they learn God's way of life that will be taught to the whole world after Jesus Christ returns. Now, most Arabs are Muslims. So as we look at the animosity between Arabs and Jews, we'll also look at the major religion in the Arab world, which is Islam. And we'll see the role that it plays in the seemingly never-ending conflict between Arabs and Jews. But first, why do Arabs and Jews have all this hatred for one another? Now, many think it's just a fight over land. Many think it's just another religious conflict, one of many around the world. So is this conflict between Arab and Jew any different? I think we know that it's not. No, this conflict started out in a way that most people today do not understand. In fact, most people today cannot understand it. If only the Palestinian-Israeli conflict was as simple as being about two religions fighting with one another. If only it was as simple as just a fight over land. But it's not. It goes much deeper than that. Brethren, let's go back to the book of Genesis, which is a book of beginnings, including the beginning of a conflict that takes center stage on the world today. Let's go back and read about Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. And we'll also take a look at what Muslims in the Quran say about Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. Because remember, most Arabs are followers of Islam. And people of Islam look to Abraham as their father, the father of many nations. Let's go to Genesis 17 and let's pick it up in verse 1. Genesis 17, verse 1. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you will multiply and will multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Jump down to verse 15. Then God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael may live before you. Then God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make of him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. So the covenant with Abraham was to continue through his son, but not Ishmael, his son, through by Hagar, Sarah's servant, but by his son Isaac, by his wife Sarah. Now let me read from a book giving the Islamic belief regarding Abraham. And some of you may remember, I have used this book before. It's called Understanding Islam by Yahya Emmerich. It's actually the complete idiot's guide to understanding Islam. Similar to Books for Dummies, they have these in just about any subject. And it makes things very clear. So to understand Islam better, I got this book. So let me read part of what we just read, or about what we just read. And this is picking it up in midstream, basically. Now, as he rested with Hagar and their son, Abraham's great test was about to occur. The aged patriarch saw in a dream that he was sacrificing his son on an altar. When Abraham told his son about this, the boy courageously replied, "Do as you have been commanded." Abraham took the boy into the wilderness and tied him to a stone outcropping. Imagine the stress and anxiety felt by both. Abraham was being asked to take the life of his own beloved son, and the boy was lying there, knowing that his own father was about to kill him. But just as Abraham was about to strike with the knife, an angel came to him and told him to stop, because he had already demonstrated his willingness to give up everything he loved for God's sake. Both father and son rejoiced and found a ram nearby to sacrifice instead. Now, in reading this account, you may have noticed that the boy who is going to be sacrificed is not Isaac, but Ishmael, which is opposite from the biblical account of the story. Islam asserts that this story took place in the Valley of Baca, and that because God spared Ishmael and tested Abraham's faith, a great shrine would be built by the pair in celebration. This would be the forerunner of the present-day Kaaba. Big difference here, isn't there? As the years passed, Ishmael was blessed with prophethood, and he gave the message of surrendering to God's will to the nomads of the desert. He continued the tradition established by his father of bringing servants of God to the shrine for pilgrimage. Eventually, people began settling in the Valley of Baca, and the name was later changed to Mecca. The Quran itself notes both the ancient name Baca and the modern one, Mecca. After many more centuries had passed, Mecca became a vibrant town. But Abraham's religion was not to survive there intact. Gradually, people began to develop false ideas about spirits and a plurality of gods. It would be many years before God would send the right prophet to clean up those false ideas and restore the Kaaba, or the shrine, to the worship of the one true God. That prophet, who would be a descendant of the prophet Abraham, through his son Ishmael, was named Muhammad. And to this day, Muslims make a pilgrimage to Mecca, which is located in today, where is today, Saudi Arabia. Some of you may remember a year or a year and a half or so ago, over 2,000 pilgrims were crushed to death as they marched around the shrine at Mecca. And that's what a faithful Muslim is supposed to do at least once in his lifetime or her lifetime, go make a pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, some may think, well, Jews, Christians, and Muslims all look back to Abraham. So that means that all three religions are related. So why the animosity between them or among them? Well, that is a good question. And we're going to find the answer in the Bible. Let's go back to Genesis, Genesis 16. I'm going to read this from the New International Version. Genesis 16, we'll pick it up in verse 11. Let's see some prophecies from the Bible concerning Ishmael. Genesis 16, verse 11. From the NIV. The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now with child and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael." And Ishmael means God will hear. "For the Lord has heard your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. The New King James Version says wild man. And when I read this, I always picture, we've seen news accounts of the Arabs celebrating or being angry about something, and they're all raising their hands, they're shooting off their guns and rifles, just screaming. And that's what I picture when I hear that they're going to be a wild donkey of a man or a wild man. Continuing verse 12. His hand, talking about Ishmael, his descendants and his descendants, will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility towards all his brothers. The New Revised Standard Version says, and he shall live at odds with all his kin. Verse 13. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You are the God who sees me, for you said, I have now seen the one who sees me. And then verse 15. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. So God said that Ishmael would be at odds with his relatives. Let's take a little look at some of Ishmael's relatives. Now, as we know, Ishmael and Isaac were brothers. Abraham was their father. Of course, Jacob was Isaac's son. So Ishmael was Jacob's uncle. And Jacob and Ishmael's sons were first cousins. And Jacob's, or Israel, as he became to know, be known as, 12 sons were first cousins once removed to Ishmael's sons. Still with me? Just remember, they're all kin to one another. Let's look at Genesis 25, verse 12. Genesis 25, verse 12. And again, we'll notice something about Ishmael's offspring. And again, I'd like to read this from the NIV. Genesis 25, picking up in verse 12. This is the account of Abraham's son Ishmael, whom Sarah's maidservant Hagar the Egyptian bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael, listed in the order of their birth. And then through verse 15, names all the sons. Then in verse 16, these were the sons of Ishmael. And these are the names of the 12 tribal rulers according to their settlements and camps. Altogether, Ishmael lived 137 years. He breathed his last and died, and he was gathered to his people. In verse 18, his descendants settled in the area from Havilah to Shur, near the border of Egypt, as you go down to Asher. And they lived in hostility towards all their brothers. You know, many of the Arab peoples today are descendants of Abraham through Ishmael. And if you study their history, if you've ever read Lawrence of Arabia, that talks about how the warring Arab tribes finally came together because of Lawrence of Arabia. But if you look at their history, you'll see that the various Arab tribes and then nation states never got along with one another. And they really still don't. You know, they may be at peace with one another, but they really don't like one another. Some of you remember when Saddam Hussein had his army invade brother Arabs, Kuwait. Then other Arab nations joined against Arab Iraq to free them. Now, if anyone looks closely at how Arab countries support the Palestinians today, they'll see that publicly, yes, they do support the Palestinians. With their words, they will support them. But you know, behind the scene, they've done really very little to help the Palestinians. All those oil-rich Arab countries, this is even before the price of oil dropped, did very little to help the Palestinians, many of whom just live in poverty in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. These Arab countries could have been helping the Palestinians much more material down through the years. They could be doing so much more for their brother Arabs and Muslims, but they don't. So the descendants of Ishmael were prophesied not to get along with their own family, including Isaac and his descendants. And today the world doesn't realize that Arabs and Jews, Arabs and Israel, are family who can't get along. It's all a family feud. And the family feud started actually with Sarah and Ishmael. And then Ishmael and Isaac, brother against brother, and then cousins against cousins. And it continues to this day. Now, does Islam add fuel to the fire in the Middle East? Does it help keep the family feud going? Let's see what the author of Understanding Islam has to say about that. He writes, "It is not an article of faith for Muslims to destroy Israel. If the issue of Jerusalem could be solved to the satisfaction of the world's Muslims and the injustices done against the Palestinians resolved, then perhaps the modern state of Israel could exist in peace in the Middle East. Muslim rulers during the Crusades often made peace treaties with the Europeans. As of this writing, two Arab countries have already concluded treaties with the Jewish-dominated state of Israel." Of course, that's Egypt and Jordan. "More might be willing to do the same if the Israelis would concede that wrongs were done and that Jerusalem should be the property of all the religions that claim it, or the property of none at all." Stay tuned. That's how he puts it. So his view is basically that religion in relation to Jerusalem is the main factor in the continuity of the conflict. And I think we can see that it does add to it. And as he said, stay tuned. Or as we like to say, watch and be ready. Now sometimes, I will catch some of the Sunday morning preachers on TV. And I'll listen to them for a few minutes or so as I flip through the stations. And I remember one time, I came upon this very well-known preacher, and he was talking about Islam. That caught my attention. And he was not saying nice things about Islam. In fact, he said that the Quran tells Muslims to kill Christians and Jews. He was very emphatic about that. And some of you may have heard other people say that yes, the Quran says to kill Christians, tells Muslims to kill Christians and Jews. Now, I have an article here by Dave Hunt, author of A Woman Rides the Beast. Some of you have read that book or are at least familiar with it. Let me read some statements that he makes about Islam in an article called A Moment for Truth. And here he's talking about September 11th. "What cause could so powerfully motivate educated and trained individuals to sacrifice their own lives and the lives of so many total strangers in this manner? In the minds of civilized people, these men were unbelievable fanatics. But were they? Could one call the spiritual leader of an entire major country a fanatic, a man universally recognized as properly representing his religion? Who would know his religion better than the spiritual leader himself? Such was Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini when he declared the purest joy in Islam is to kill and be killed for Allah. Is that fanaticism?" he writes. "We have arrived at a defining moment when truth could triumph if the world would recognize that terrorists are not fanatics, but devout fundamentalist Muslims who are earnestly following their religion." So writes Mr. Hunt in that article. After reading that article and seeing that preacher on TV and what he said about Islam, and of course then remembering events of 9/11 and then now recently what happened in Paris and in California, I want to know, what exactly does Islam teach? What does the Quran say about what's most people say it says, specifically in relation to Christians and Jews? Does the Quran teach that what these men and others say it does? That's why I got the Quran. That's why I got this book on Understanding Islam, to try to get at the facts. And this book on Understanding Islam, of course, is pro-Islam. I wanted something pro-Islam to balance things out, because obviously that article, that preacher, were anti-Islam. So let me read from Understanding Islam again. He writes, given that Islam recognizes that Jews and Christians received authentic prophets and revelations in the past, because the Quran recognizes Moses as a prophet, as we read about Jesus. The Quran uses a special title to separate them from mere idolaters. This term is Al-Kabab, or people of the book. It is an allusion to the fact that Jews and Christians received holy books from God long before and can be counted on to have certain ideas and concepts that are similar to Islam's. The people of the book have such an elevated status that according to Islamic law, a Muslim man is allowed to marry a practicing Jewish or Christian woman, and he's not allowed to force her to convert or curtail her religious freedom. Some of us a little older remember Arafat, leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. He was married to an Arab Christian woman. A lot of people didn't realize that. Now, the author then goes on to talk about the problems that their prophet Muhammad had with the Jews. Let me read another section here. In addition, meat prepared by Jews and Christians, Now, over the centuries, much misinformation has surfaced concerning the conception of Judaism in Islam. Some of it can be traced to long-held prejudices and historical misunderstandings, and some of it is due to the fact that the current state of relations between Israel and the Muslim world leaves a lot to be desired. Sadly, in modern times, the misinterpretation of historical events and the use of Quranic verses out of context have allowed some Western writers to contribute to the problem. And we're going to take a bit of a look at that, too. He continues, the Quranic revelations received by Muhammad painted a picture of Judaism as it was then practiced that was extremely unflattering. The Quran accused the Jews of practicing racial discrimination and hypocrisy. It said that they were not following the teachings of Moses and that their customs had no authority from God. But the worst of it, from the Jewish point of view, was still to come. When Muhammad first arrived in Medina, the Jews had been hopeful that he would denounce Jesus as an imposter. Judaism holds that Jesus is a false rabbi. But instead of rejecting Jesus, the Quran called him the Jewish Messiah and a messenger from God who was sent to call the wayward Jews back to true faith. Such a view was totally unacceptable to the Jews, and the situation deteriorated from there. So this is what the author of Islam says was the problem. Not that Muhammad and his followers hated the Jews, it's because of how they practiced their religion, which was not the way they should have been practicing it. Now I want to look at some verses of the Quran, especially those that many people say to kill Christians and Jews. And that was the main reason why I got the Quran. Let me first read from Understanding Islam again, because he quotes the scripture from the Quran. He quotes, it's Quran 2, verse 62, or sometimes it's called Surah 2, 62. It says, rest assured that Muslims, Jews, Christians, and Sabians, whoever believes in God and the last day and performs good deeds, will be rewarded by their Lord. They will have nothing to fear or regret. And he's quoting from the Quran there. And that is an accurate quote from the Quran that I had. Then he had another one that he doesn't quote it, he just refers to it. It says, many Jews do not keep God's laws about the Sabbath, kosher, and other things. And he quotes Quran 4:47. And I think all of us could agree, too, that many Jews do not keep God's laws about the Sabbath, kosher, and other things. But let me read from the Quran of that verse that he was quoting. Well, he didn't quote a verse, he just listed the verse in the Quran and said that's what it's referring to. So I looked up that verse, and this is what it says. Among the Jews who are those who displace the words of their scriptures and say, "We have heard, and we have not obeyed. Hear thou, but as one that heareth not, and look at us, perplexing with their tongues and wounding the faith by their revilings. But if they would say, 'We have heard and we obey,' hear thou and regard us, it were better for them and more right. But God hath cursed them for their unbelief. Few only of them are believers." So he said, he quotes the Quran 447, saying they don't keep God's laws about the Sabbath, kosher, and other things. And it doesn't exactly say that, but it does refer that there are Jews who don't and Jews who do. Now, I found in reading Understanding Islam that the author makes statements about what Islam is and isn't, but doesn't always quote from the Quran to support his views. But then, of course, there are Christian writers who do the same about Christianity, make statements about what Christianity is or what it isn't, without quoting the Bible to support their views. But the comments that stand out in my mind about the Quran are the comments that many people say for Muslims to kill all Christians and Jews. Those are the ones that I wanted to look at. And Mr. Hunt had this to say in his article, and he refers to the Quran. He writes, "There are more than 100 verses in the Quran advocating the use of violence to spread Islam. In the Quran, Allah commands Muslims, 'Take not the Jews and Christians as friends.'" And that's part of a verse. And he gives a part of another verse, "Slay the idolaters, non-Muslims, wherever you find them." And another verse, "Fight against such as believe not in Allah." And he gives the places in the Quran where he says that's what it says. And he continues, "So most Muslims would shrink from obeying such commands. This is official Islam, and it cannot change without admitting that Muhammad was a false prophet and a murderer." That's what Mr. Hunt has to say. So what I wanted to do is read from the Quran the verses that he was quoting there and see what the Quran actually says. So one verse he said, "Take not the Jews." Let's see what that says. It says, "O believers, take not the Jews or Christians as friends. They are but one another's friends. If any one of you taketh them for his friends, he is surely one of them. God will not guide the evildoers." So that seems to support what he's saying there, doesn't it? Isn't it? Next one, he said, "Slay the idolater." Let's see what that verse has to say. I went back and didn't want to take it out of context either. "An immunity from God and his apostle to those with whom ye are in league among the polytheist Arabs, those who join gods with gods. When the sacred months are past, kill those who join other gods with God wherever ye shall find them, and seize them, besiege them, and lay wait for them with every kind of ambush. But if they shall convert and observe prayer and pay the obligatory alms, then let them go their way, for God is gracious, merciful." So the article made it sound like anyone who's a non-Muslim is to be killed. But when you read the Quran with what he was quoting from, the verses, at least in this translation, refer to polytheist Arabs, those who practice had many gods. And it says to go on and fight against them. It continues, "So make war on them. By your hands, God will chastise them and will put them to shame, and will give you victory over them, and will heal the bosoms of people who believe." So, are y'all clear about what the Quran says about Jews and Christians today? Not exactly. Well, I'm not either. The conclusion that I've come from after reading Understanding Islam, and I read the whole book, I didn't read the whole Quran, but I went through many, many, many verses that he was quoting in the Quran. And the conclusion that I've come to is that there are many people who practice Islam who will say that Islam teaches so-and-so, while others will disagree and say, no, Islam teaches this and that. And then there'll still be others who'll say, no, Islam teaches X, Y, and Z. But you know what? There's another major world religion that I can say the same thing about. It's called Christianity. Because there are a myriad of beliefs in the world of Christianity that people say they all get from the same book. So I'm not surprised that there are Muslims like those in ISIS and Al-Qaeda who believe that the Quran says to kill non-Muslims, all non-Muslims. While other Muslims will say, no, the Quran does not say that. But, and to me this is the important part, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where Israel is concerned. Because the Arab people would be against Israel, talking about the modern state of Israel and the descendants of Israel today. They'd be against them even if there had never been a prophet Muhammad or the Quran. The conflict between Arabs and Jews was prophesied some 4,000 years ago, about 2,500 years before the prophet Muhammad ever came on the scene. So it doesn't matter. Now, before we look at another piece of the conflict in the Middle East, I'd like to take a look at this Arabic word, jihad. We've all heard that word. It's bandied about quite a bit in the Muslim world. Jihad. How many times do we see the mobs of Arabs, again, just jumping and screaming and shooting guns off, shouting out, death to America, death to Israel, as they call for a jihad against us? Let me read again from Understanding Islam about this word, jihad. He writes, jihad in Arabic means to struggle or strive for something. It does not mean a holy war, as English dictionaries often mislabel it. But he continues, however, the word jihad is most often associated with the act of physically confronting evil and wrongdoing. Hence, it can be applied to the act of fighting as well. But the goal of a physical jihad is not to have a big war, gain riches, or kill people, is to further the cause of Allah and to create justice on the earth. Then when the evil is removed or the other side wants peace, Muslims are to make peace as well. Those who believe fight in the cause of God, and those who reject faith fight in the cause of evil. So fight against the friends of Shaitan. And Shaitan is the Arabic word for Satan. And of course, what do many Muslims and Arabs call the United States? Well, we're called the great Satan. Now, the original meaning, after I've read all this, or intent of the word jihad, may not have been holy war. I can concede that to this author. But how do these terrorists and Muslim extremists of this world use the word jihad? Well, as a holy war against America, against Israel. Do you think the Muslim extremists of this world care if they misuse the word jihad? No. If they want the word jihad to mean holy war, then that's what it means. And it obviously does mean that to them. And that's how they use it. And I don't know about you, but I take it seriously when Muslims use the word jihad against America or Israel. You know, it's estimated now to be about 1.9 billion Muslims in the world today. And in case you're wondering, there's over 2.2 billion Christians, as they call Christianity. But 1.9 billion Muslims. It only will take a small percentage of Muslims to believe in a jihad, a holy war against Israel, to cause problems. And of course, they have. And I think we all know they're going to continue to do so. As the author of Islam said, stay tuned. Now, before we look at the conflict between Arabs and Jews, when it will end, I want to take a brief look at a people called the Amalekites. Let's go over to 1 Samuel 15. We'll start in verse 1. 1 Samuel 15, starting in verse 1. Descendants of the Amalekites may have something to do with the hatred today of Arabs towards all the descendants of Israel. 1 Samuel 15, verse 1. Samuel also said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, heed the voice of the Lord, words of the Lord, the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." That's what God said to do. God wanted the Amalekites completely destroyed. No one, nothing was to be left. Why? It says because of what they did to Israel as they came out of Egypt. They fought against Israel. They killed a lot of the stragglers in that great march out of Egypt. Now, some people read this and think that God was harsh in commanding Saul to totally and utterly destroy the Amalekites. Well, let's go back, or not go back, but yeah, it is going back to Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. And we'll see that the Amalekites were a thorn in Israel's side, and God knew they would continue to torment Israel if they weren't completely dealt with. Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 through 19. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you and on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God is giving to you to possess as inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget." And I want you to remember about them, being told not to remember Amalek, to not to forget them. We're going to bring something up a little later about that. Now let's go back again to 1 Samuel 15. And we'll see that Saul did not obey God's command to destroy Amalek. 1 Samuel 15, we'll pick it up in verse 7. "And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He also took King Agag, king of the Amalekites." And remember that name again, Agag, king of the Amalekites. We're going to come back to that. "And utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword." Oh, so Saul did obey God after all, did he? Well, no, he didn't. Let's continue in verse 9. "But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night." And what did Saul have to say about disobeying God? Well, let's read it. So it starts in verse 13. And brethren, as we read this, let's remember that this is what carnal human nature is like. This is what our human carnal nature is like. 1 Samuel 15, verse 13. "Then Samuel said to Saul, and Saul said to him, Blessed are you, the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." And I like Samuel's sarcasm here. Verse 14. "But Samuel said, What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best." It wasn't me. It's the people who did it. It's not my fault. "For the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." Verse 18. Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. Can you just picture him whining this? I have. It's the people didn't do it. But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. And these next verses are also verses we need to heed. So Samuel said, has the Lord has great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice and to heed the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. And of course, our stubbornness is always righteous stubbornness, isn't it? Our stubbornness could never be like iniquity and idolatry. Yeah. In case you're wondering, there's a little bit of sarcasm I'm throwing at all of us. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. So this story teaches us about obedience to God in all matters. Big matters, small matters, doesn't matter. God expects obedience. God demands obedience, complete obedience in all matters. But what do the Amalekites have to do with the situation in the Middle East today? What do they have to do with the tragic events of 9/11, if anything? What do they have to do with ISIS or the tragic event in Paris, all those killings, if anything? Well, who is Amalek? Well, let's go back to Genesis again. Genesis 36, verse 12. And we'll see that Amalek was a grandson of Esau. And in verse 1 and also in Genesis 25:30, Esau is called Edom. Remember that name too, Edom. Esau was Jacob slash Israel's brother and, of course, Isaac's son. So Ishmael was also Esau's uncle. Uh-oh, more genealogies coming up, huh? All right, let's see. Genesis 36, verse 12. Now, Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. So, Ishmael's sons and Amalek were first cousins twice removed because, and I have to read this to keep track of all this, because Esau and Ishmael's sons were first cousins, and Esau's sons were first cousins once removed to Ishmael's sons. And the 12 sons of Israel and Amalek were first cousins once removed. Okay, enough already with the once removed and twice removed and all that. Again, just remember, what all this means is that the Amalekites and the Israelites were related. They're all kin to one another. They were family. And the Amalekites were right in there with the family feud. So do we hear any more of the Amalekites after Saul doesn't obey God by destroying them as he was told? And yes, we do. Let's go back to 1 Samuel again. 1 Samuel 28, verse 17. If Saul had obeyed God concerning the Amalekites, things could have been different for Saul. Definitely would have been different for Israel. 1 Samuel 28, verses 17 and 18. The Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. So now David had to deal with the Amalekites. But the Amalekites were never completely destroyed, as God had told Saul to do. Let's look at 2 Samuel 1, beginning in verse 1. 2 Samuel 1, let's start in verse 1. Second Samuel 1, verse 1. And it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag, on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was, when he came to David, that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, "Where have you come from?" So he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Then David said to him, "How did the matter go? Please tell me." And he answered, "The people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also." So David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan his son are dead?" Then the young man who told him said, "As I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear. And indeed the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. So when he looked behind him, he saw me and called for me. And I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' So I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite. And he said to me again, 'Please stand over and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me.' So I stood over him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet was on his arm, and it brought them here to my Lord." Because the Amalekites, because of them, Saul was removed as king over Israel. And instead of Saul killing the Amalekites, as he was told, we see an Amalekite killed Saul. So what happened to the Amalekites? Let's go over to 1 Chronicles 4, verse 42. 1 Chronicles 4, verses 42 and 43. Because the descendants of Amalek, the Amalekites, continued in their fights against Israel and their descendants. 1 Chronicles 4, verses 42 and 43. "And some of them, 500 men of the sons of Simeon, went to Mount Seir, having as their captains Pelatiah, Neariah, Rephaiah, and Uzziel, the sons of Ishi, and they defeated the rest of the Amalekites who had escaped. They have dwelt there to this day." So they have lived or dwelt there to this day, and they are still in the Middle East. Let's go over to Psalm 83, verse 3. And as you're turning there, let me ask you this question. Today, is there just one Arab nation involved in the fight against Israel? And of course, I think we know what there isn't. It seems about the only thing that unites the Arab people is their hatred of Israel. And you know, that really includes Egypt and Jordan. Yes, both of them have signed peace treaties with Israel, but both of them support the Palestinians over Israel. Psalm 83, verses 3 through 7. And again, I'd like to read this from the NIV. Verse 3, "With cunning they despair against your people. They plot against those you cherish. Come, they say, let us destroy them as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. With one mind they plot together, they form an alliance against you. The tents of Edom," and again Edom is Esau, "and the Ishmaelites, O Moed, and the Hagarites, Gebal, Ammon, and Amalek, Philistia with the people of Tyre." A few years ago I was listening to a sermon, and we've had trips to Israel during the spring holidays on and off, and we're having it again this year. But this was a few years ago, and I believe the pastor was David Register that went on this, but I may be wrong on that. But I was listening to one of his sermons, and he was talking about the tour of the Holy Land, and they were on the tour bus, and as the bus is going, there would be an Israeli soldier walking along the side of the road, and the bus driver would pick him up and give him a ride. Just they'd hop on there and stand and go down and come off. And as the soldier got on the bus, he would say something to, or she in Israel, would say something to the bus driver in Hebrew, and the bus driver would repeat the same thing in Hebrew. Of course, Mr. Register, the other passengers, didn't understand Hebrew, so didn't know what they were saying. But every time a soldier did that, because they picked up several soldiers at the time, they got on the bus, they would say something in Hebrew, and the bus driver would repeat it. So later, when Mr. Register had a chance to talk to the bus driver, he asked them, what were the soldiers saying to you as they got on the bus, and you were repeating to them? We don't understand Hebrew. And the bus driver said, they were saying, remember Amalek. And I said that back to them, remember Amalek. To this day, people in the nation of Israel remember Amalek. They're the type of people now that don't forget. They also have a saying, never again, referring to the Holocaust. We didn't have time, I wish we did, to go to the book of Esther. I'll just briefly tell you what I was going to go over. But if you're familiar with in Esther, one of the king's high officials, Haman, tricked the king, basically, into putting out a decree that all Jews were going to be killed on a certain day, because he had a hatred for all the Jews, and he wanted them utterly destroyed in the kingdom. If you go to the book of Esther, you'll see that Haman was an Agagite. Remember I said, remember King Agag? He was descended from his side of the family, who was the king of the Amalekites. So Haman, in the book of Esther, was a descendant of the Amalekites, who wanted to destroy all the Jews. So, who are the Amalekites today? Only God knows exactly. But their descendants are there today in the Middle East, and they're still fighting against Israel. Could some of the ISIS fighters from the Middle East be Amalekites? Could some of Al-Qaeda's members be Amalekites? Will Amalekites be directly involved in end-time prophecies described in Matthew 24 and Daniel and other books of the Bible, especially Revelation? Again, only God knows. But we do know that the descendants are still around in the Middle East. They are still involved in the family feud. However, we do know when this family feud will end. Let's turn over to Matthew 24. Let's do a quick review on when it will end. Matthew 24, let's pick it up in verse 13. Hopefully very familiar scriptures to us. Matthew 24, verse 13. And he who endures to the end shall be saved. Another memory scripture for all of us. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and this has not happened yet. Verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor shall ever be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Again, some very terrifying scriptures that we read here. And I think we know that what happened on September 11th is nothing, totally nothing compared to what's going to happen during the tribulation. September 11th was just an infinitesimal foretaste of what the tribulation is going to be like. Drop down to verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Of course, that describes the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. This will be the beginning of the end of that family feud that still goes on in the Middle East. You know, many people still can't believe what happened in our country on September 11th. They can't believe what happened in Paris just the other week, or in San Bernardino, California. And what happened on those days was terrible. What happened was horrible. But we must remember that there is going to come a time when the whole world is going to be devastated. Horrible won't even begin to describe what's going to happen to this world in the last days. And before Satan is through, before he is stopped, the whole world is going to be just one big 9/11. Let's turn back to Revelation 11, verse 3. Revelation 11, verse 3. This concerns the death of the two witnesses. Let's see Satan's influence combined with carnal human nature. Because Satan and human carnal nature are working together, even today. Revelation 11, verse 3. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. Drop down to verse 11. When they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. And their dead bodies will be lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom, and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Of course, that's Jerusalem. Then those from the peoples, tribes, tongues, and nations will see their dead bodies 3.5 days and not allow their dead bodies to be put into the graves. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them, make merry, and send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. And when I read verse 10, you know what I still picture today? I picture the TV video right after 9/11 of the Palestinians in the West Bank celebrating what happened in New York. They were out in the street jumping and singing and cheering. You know, I know Donald Trump claims he saw Palestinians on rooftops in Jersey City. I don't remember seeing that, and no one can find anything on that. But I specifically remember Palestinians in the West Bank celebrating over 9/11. Some of you may remember that. Can you imagine singing and dancing and cheering over such a horrific event? But that's how much the descendants of Ishmael and Amalek hate Israel. That's how much they hate America. Now, the Arab people don't hate the Jews, don't hate America, don't hate Israel because they're Muslims and the others are Christians and Jews. No, the Arabs could be Coptic Christian and some are. The Arabs could be Orthodox Christian and some are. They could be Catholic, Buddhist, Hindu, Baptist, Pentecostal, or they all can convert to Judaism. It won't matter. Because the Arabs, the descendants of Ishmael, Edom, and Amalek, among others, would still hate Israel. And it all goes back to Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. Islam is not the root cause of the conflict, but it does add to it. And the Arabs will continue to make war against Israel, and Satan will continue to spur it all on. And Satan will use various means to try to get what he wants. And you know, sometimes Satan's ways on the surface will sound good. But if Satan is behind it, be assured that its end will be nothing but evil. You know, this was in the news recently, some of you may have seen it. Saudi Arabia announced that it has formed an Islamic confederation of 34 Arab and Muslim countries. And their mission in coming together is to fight against Islamic terrorism. And this apparently was in response to criticism from the U.S. and Western Europe that the Arab and Muslim countries aren't really doing much to fight against Islamic terrorism. Now, I'm a type that like to ask myself questions. Now, if this Islamic Confederation, let's say it is successful in eliminating ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorists, what will it do then? Will it just disband? Because their mission is accomplished, or could they morph into something else? Could they grow, but in a different direction, add to their numbers, but this time not working with the West, but working against the West? And, you know, if something like that happens, could we see then the start of some major Bible prophecies being fulfilled by the forming of a even more vast Islamic confederation? Again, only God knows. Please turn to Revelation 19, verse 11, as we begin to close for today. Revelation 19, verse 11. The descendants of Ishmael, the descendants of Amalek want war, and they're going to get what they want. But the time is coming when they'll wish that they never got what they wanted. Because unfortunately for them, they either ignore or forget Jesus Christ in all of this. Revelation 19, verse 11. And I love reading these scriptures, especially on the Feast of Trumpets. Revelation 19, verse 11. Now I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. Yes, the Islamic extremists will get what they want. They'll get a holy war, but with the true Holy One, Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ will give them war. Verse 12, his eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heavens, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And Jesus Christ will put an end to all this. Jesus Christ will put an end to the war on terrorism. And when Jesus Christ returns, this war will be the war to end all wars. Please turn with me to Micah 4, verse 1, as for a final scripture. Micah 4, verse 1. And Micah is after Jonah in the minor prophets. The time is coming when the Osama bin Ladens of this world, and there are many, the time is coming when they will learn to live by these scriptures. Micah 4, verse 1. Now shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. And I love that last verse. Neither shall they learn war any more. Now that is something that people, all people, should be dancing and cheering and shouting for joy in the streets over. That is something to celebrate over. When the whole world learns God's way of life, when the whole world walks in his paths. Because then and only then will there be no more 9/11. Then and only then will there be no more ISIS or terror attacks like we had in Paris and California. Then and only then will this war on terrorism end. And as the last part of verse 5 says, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. We will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Not the God of Islam, but the true God. And then there'll be no more terrorists, no more hatred, no more family feud. That time is coming, brethren. As we all know we are to do, let's make sure we all watch and be ready. And let's make sure we follow the true God in the true book. Let's make sure we stay tuned. Because as we know, there is a lot more still to come. Good Sabbath, brethren.